Hello and welcome to the Farmhouse Podcast, where we talk to movers and shakers in innovation about their journeys and what's next. I'm Paul Earle, Executive Director. We are back after a brief hiatus towards the end of the last year and back with a bang. Today we're thrilled to be talking to Mr. Pablos Holman, futurist, inventor, and notable, and frankly sometimes notorious, hacker with a unique view into breaking and building new technologies. Pablos has consulted around the world on invention and design projects that assimilate new technologies, in his words, making wild ideas a bit more practical and vice versa. He was a top dog at former Microsoft CTO Nathan Myhrvold's Skunkworks, which is basically kind of like a James Bond lab. And at present, he is founder and CEO of Bombsheller, which is doing wild and exciting things in, of all categories, women's tights. I met Pablos several years ago at the Kellogg Innovation Network conference, where he gave a keynote address during which, in real time, before our very eyes, as if it's magic, he happened to steal, I don't know if I can use that word steal, I'll say assimilate, the credit card number of a member of the audience right there before our eyes, even when an audience member, who at the time was the chief information officer of American Express, stood up during the talk and rather sternly said it couldn't be done. So we'll ask Pablos about that in a second. He's a fascinating dude with a fascinating story, and we're happy to hear Pablos tell it to us. Pablos, welcome.
Thank you.
All right. So before we hear the story of Bombsheller, your work with Myhrvold and other adventures, how in the world did you steal that guy's credit card? What happened?
The credit card industry has this weird thing going where, you know, credit cards have been insecure for a really long time. Everybody knows that you can pretty much just, you know, if you're a waitress, take a pencil rubbing of a credit card and go buy some stuff with it. And it's always been baffling to hackers that they don't try to make it more secure. And so a few years back, we got these new credit cards in the mail that came with a letter explaining how this is the new secure credit card. And we got really excited about that because we don't usually get stuff in the mail that says it's secure. And so the reason that they said it was secure is that they had put RFID chips in the credit card. And these are little chips with an antenna on them that can basically talk wirelessly to a reader. And we know a little bit about computer chips and how they work. And so we were thinking that the credit card info is probably on that chip and encrypted. And if we could just figure out how to crack the encryption, then maybe we could steal credit card numbers wirelessly. And
They were almost like baiting you. I mean, it was almost like you're being antagonized. You're being antagonized, right.
By the credit card industry. So we bought a bunch of RFID gear on the internet to work on this project. One of the things we got was a reader from eBay for like $8. That's the same one that's on the counter at Starbucks or in all the taxi cabs in New York. You know, it's the new PayPass reader. And so we had to figure out how to make a, you know, connector to plug it into our computer. And then once you do that and write a little bit of code, not very hard stuff, the thing will just suck up credit card numbers from RFID credit cards. They're called PayPass cards or Blink cards. And it turns out that there was no crypto involved. It was really easy and kind of embarrassingly easy. And so now that I have that reader, I can just go hang out at Starbucks and swipe people's butts with it, and I get their credit card numbers. So what I did at that event was the same thing. I managed to steal some credit card numbers that way. The guys, executives from American Express and Discover Card were in the audience. And they complained, as the credit card industry does, that, you know, I was making it seem easier than it was. It was pretty easy. I don't know. You could pretty much do the same thing. They have taken steps in the years, to be fair, you know, in the years since they first did these cards. They started doing some tricky stuff. So, like, the first got had my name on it. So I just swipe your butt and I get your name and your credit card number. And then the second version, and the expiration date and stuff, the second version, they took the name off. And then American Express said, you know, now it's more secure because you don't get the name.
Right.
So, you know, they've gone through some different iterations. And then and the latest version of it, of course, is Apple Pay, which uses that same infrastructure and talks to it from an iPhone. And they've done some things to improve the protocol so that, like an iPhone doesn't just broadcast your credit card number. It only sends it when you push, you know, put your finger on the button.
Right.
So maybe it's better. I haven't looked into that. Things are improved in a way.
What's amazing about that story, first of all, you did it live. I mean, that was literally like watching a David Copperfield magic show or something.
Yeah.
Which reminds me of one of my favorite quotes from Arthur C. Clarke. A sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. So you were literally performing magic before our very eyes. But what also is amazing, and we see this all the time, is the cost of equipment it required to assemble that device was like $20.
Yeah,
you could buy it at Radio Shack, right?
Yeah, I spent a couple $1,000s on equipment, but the only equipment I really needed was the $8 reader.
Right? It's just unbelievable. Yeah. And, you know, the Amex guy, he was genuinely upset. I mean, he basically, you can't do this. And when he said you can't, he meant you shouldn't, but also you can't. And actually... Yeah.
He still didn't believe it.
He still didn't believe it.
What he was thinking. Yeah, it's a weird thing because, I mean, a couple things. Like, one is I didn't pay enough attention to Arthur C. Clarke, and half of the time when I tried to show people that hack, it didn't work. You know, I'd be on stage and somebody would bring up a credit card that it didn't work on, and I didn't know why. But the reason why is hackers don't have real, like, you know, quality assurance departments, so we can't test it a bunch. And, you know, and when I got a credit card or like the European credit cards it didn't work on, it probably just needs a little more work to make it work. But eventually I had these magicians in my audience. Magicians told me, you know, what you're doing is kind of like a magic show. And I said, oh yeah, good point. You should tell me how to make it better. And they said, well, magicians would never do a trick unless they were 100% sure it was going to work. Because they said, nobody ever wants to see a trick that doesn't work. And I said, oh, yeah, good point. I guess I should stop doing demos that aren't reliable. And so these days I don't show those things off as much anymore because it's too much work to make them work reliably.
Well, if you talk to a magician and you ask him about his tricks and he doesn't tell you, that's okay. You can just hack him. You'll figure out what he's doing.
It's actually been the other way around. I have all these magicians stalking me because they want to learn how to put these hacking tricks in their shows. And one of them got carried away with it, and he put all these hacking tricks into shows, and he started doing, you know, things that are a little bit crazy, I think. But, you know, it's amazing. Magicians are amazing because of they are like hackers. You know, they'll put in unrealistic amount of work into something that doesn't make any sense for anybody to put that much work into.
For some historical reference to our listeners, the Kellogg Innovation Network is a group of about 250 or 300 leaders in innovation from all different sectors. It has former CEOs, chief innovation officers, former generals and admirals from the military, CIA, you know, all these people are in the audience. And when Pablos pulled this off in real time, I mean, there were gasps. It was one of the more amazing public performances I've seen. So that's how I met Pablos, and I'm glad I did. All right, Pablos, tell us about Bombsheller. When I first heard you were doing this, I thought, okay, that's pretty cool. And then I thought, what's the catch? Is this like a Trojan horse that is part of some kind of global domination scheme? I mean, you're a very well-known technologist and hacker and futurist, and to go into the tights business is not something anyone would have predicted.
Right.
However, if you think about it differently, maybe there is a master plan here, and you're just picking a well-defined vertical to hack. So tell us about Bombsheller. Where the inspiration came from and what you're up to today.
Yeah, so I always have a master plan. Doesn't always go the way I plan, but I'll start back with, you know, the lab, because at the lab, what I'm doing is trying to invent new technologies that are 5 or 10 years in the future. And that's a pretty unusual job. Most people, at best, are trying to invent something they can ship next year, you know, a faster, cheaper version of whatever they shipped last year. And so most people don't have the job of inventing the next generation technologies that aren't going to be possible or make sense for at least 5 or 10 years. But that's what we do at the Intellectual Ventures Lab. And the problem with that business is that you're wrong almost all the time.
Right, right.
So we aim for a batting average of 1 in 1,000, like a batting average of 1. We expect to invent 1,000 things and have one of them pay off.
And actually, the math on that works, because that one could be so profound
that
it pays for the other 999.
You got it. And that's, to everyone else in the world, it sounds like a crazy business, because, you know, the craziest people right now are venture capitalists. They'll take $100 million, invest in 10 startups, and hope one of them pays for all the failures. Well, we're like 100 times crazier than them. We take $100 million, invest in 1,000 patents, and hope one of them pays for all the failures. And that's a very different kind of set of odds than most people are comfortable with.
Yep.
But when you're an inventor, you know, you have to accept that, because it's really how it goes. And so it doesn't work. We think it doesn't work that well at a small scale. If you're a lone inventor in a garage, you may come up with a couple of inventions, but the odds of them paying off are really low. Statistically, they're just going to be the ones that don't work out. So we do it at a very large scale. We file about 500 or 600 patents a year on our own inventions. Most years, we're the biggest patent filer in America.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is to go for, you know, really big things that can change the world. So most of those inventions are things that try to solve big problems.
Yep.
So at the lab, we've had some things that we think are going to be big enough that they'll pay for 999 of my failures. probably the most notorious invention, which I showed you before, is the machine that can find mosquitoes flying around and shoot them down with laser beams.
Right.
And that's an invention to help combat malaria. So we work with Bill Gates on a bunch of humanitarian projects, trying to solve the biggest problems we can find in the world.
It's like the Star Wars system,
but
for mosquitoes.
Yeah, right. Exactly right. Yeah, in fact, one of the inventors who helped come up with the idea had worked on Star Wars.
Right. Not the movie, the missile defense apparatus.
Yeah, that's right. We don't have anybody who worked on the movie.
Although that would have been cool, too.
That would have been cool. We'll try that next time.
Yeah.
So we've also invented a new type of nuclear reactor. It's powered by nuclear waste. We invented a machine that can suppress hurricanes, a new kind of antenna technology that can get gigabit wireless to everyone on the planet. So we think that it's going to work out because we do it at a large scale. And one of the areas I've been working on is trying to invent new kinds of 3D printers.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody has gotten really excited about 3D printing because it's really good for the imagination. And about 5 years ago, some friends of mine started a company called MakerBot. And so I'm an advisor for MakerBot. MakerBot is super fascinating because when they started MakerBot, again, just 5 years ago, even you had never heard of 3D printing.
Yep.
Nobody knew what it was. Even fewer people had ever even seen a machine or used one. They were $100,000 or $1 million industrial machines used for prototyping. And the guys who started MakerBot, they had never even seen one of these things, these mythical 3D printers, when they built the first MakerBot. But they're hackers, and they figured out how to make one together out of duct tape and baling wire. And started selling 3D printers that cost $2,000. And then what happened was really fascinating is lots and lots of people got excited about that because a MakerBot is a very interesting kind of robot because it's a general purpose. People understand a printer. You know, a printer doesn't care if it's printing, you know, poetry or spreadsheets or, you know, the Constitution. It's right. just a general purpose robot, and it can print anything once you've got a printer. And a 3D printer is a radically different way of making stuff. And so people get really excited about 3D printing, and now the whole world has heard about 3D printing, and thanks largely to MakerBot, there's zillions of 3D printers that are desktop 3D printers now, MakerBot and other kinds as well, that people have access to. It's making it accessible. I mean, kids in high schools have access to MakerBots now. My 8-year-old daughter is at home printing high-heeled shoes for herself on my MakerBot. So, you know, this has been a really kind of cool introduction to where robotics can go as far as making stuff, where computers can go. But at this stage, MakerBot's been around for 5 years, but 3D printers still mostly can't make anything that people want to buy. And so that's important to think about because what I'm working on is trying to imagine a future where manufacturing is done differently. So if you imagine how today's factories work, you know, you have to, you know, say you're going to make iPhone 4. Well, you make a factory automation tool for making iPhone 4, and that thing costs you $1 million.
Right.
And you amortize the cost of that machine over 1 million iPhones. And then when it's time to make iPhone 5, you throw it out, and you make a new machine that makes iPhone 5s. And there's a whole bunch of custom tooling, custom work that goes into building a factory that can make any product. And that's really, you know, worked out great for us. That's the whole point of the Industrial Revolution. We get economies of scale, and by selling zillions of the same things, everybody gets it for cheaper. The problem is that there are a lot of inefficiencies in that. And what we're imagining for the future is a factory where instead of having to guess what people are going to buy, it's easy for Apple. They know they're going to buy whatever iPhone they sell. If you're making a new product and you don't know whether it's going to sell or how many it's going to sell or what size or what color is going to sell, things like that, you have to guess all those things because you're going to make them in China and ship them to America and put them on a shelf and hope they sell out. Well, the factory of the future that we imagine and keep fantasizing about is one where you click buy now on Amazon and robots, general purpose robots, go line up in a factory, build your thing, drop it in the mail, and send it to you.
So there's no unused inventory. It's all just-in-time manufacturing.
No inventory. Well, just-in-time
inventory at all. Right.
Is a term that the industry already uses to mean that when, you know, Walmart orders 100,000 of something, all of the parts that are needed to make it show up at the factory just in time.
Right.
That's what just-in-time means right now.
Right.
There's no term, really, except for maybe on-demand manufacturing, that means that we make it on demand, just in time for the customer that's actually going to buy it and use it. So I've been thinking about this kind of thing because in the lab, what I'm trying to do is invent 3D printers that can make stuff you want to buy, more advanced 3D printing technologies. And as a way of, you know, improving my odds and inventing the right thing, I needed a way of getting my hands dirty. And so with Bombsheller, we created a company that manufactures on demand. We make clothes. Right now, the only thing we make is spandex leggings for women. But every single order is custom made. When we get an order, when you click buy now, we print your graphics in your size, and it gets cut and sewn and mailed that afternoon.
Wow.
So there's no downside for the customer. We're never out of stock on anything. Because we don't have to guess what's popular, at Bombsheller, anybody can make a design. You can make your own design. Your listeners can make their own designs. You, anybody who can draw or paint or make graphics can make a design. And we accept them all. You can submit a design. Your design can be ugly, and we'll still put it in our catalog because it doesn't matter to us. If nobody buys it, fine. If they buy it, then you get a royalty, and we make one and ship it out.
How is that different from the Threadless model? I'm sure you've studied Threadless.
Threadless is a really successful business doing something similar with T-shirts, but they don't manufacture on demand. What they do is they take they do accept submitted designs from any artist, but then there's a contest.
Right.
And you have to vote up the designs that you like, and the designs that get voted up get manufactured and sold. And there's a way to kind of do pre-orders as votes for designs. And so that's a pretty cool thing too. But they aren't trying to solve the same problems that we are. You know, they're still using screen printing, which requires tooling. You're going to take that design, you're going to make four different screens for CMYK, for different color paint, and then you're going to, you know, amortize the cost of making those screens over hundreds or thousands of shirts. And so again, it's not a digital process. It's not a way of making one. You know, we serve niche markets of one. We have designs in our catalog that only one person wants. And that's fine with us. It takes the same amount of money. It takes the same amount of time to make it and everything.
So here's what's – there are many interesting things about what you're doing. First of all, there's a reason why it's called Bombsheller and not the Holman Tights Company. and that's because, you know, tights are kind of – to me, as I understand it, they're kind of almost like a test run. You know, what you're really doing is developing technology and a method that could make any wearable. So it's possible, and tell me if I'm wrong, say that you build up your tights business and in a year from now or 2 years or whatever, it's going well and you're selling $15 million worth of tights a year. The valuation on that tights business, it will be 1x revenue or maybe 2x or 1.5 or whatever, or maybe it's a multiple of EBITDA, but it's going to be somewhere between 15 and let's just say 30 million bucks. However, the valuation of your technology and the know-how could be 100x, you know, that the valuation of the tights business. So what you're really doing is you're creating a platform.
You're right. I'm trying to get there first. And I can't do it with 3D printers because those things, like I said, aren't ready. I'm trying to invent ones that will be, but maybe in 5 years, Bombsheller can make something like shoes or sunglasses or things that should be customized for you but aren't because of the way they're manufactured.
Now, I as a dutiful, responsible reporter, I guess you could call me a reporter, kind of pseudo-reporter.
you play one on the podcast.
I play, yeah. I have to ask a devil's advocate question.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm sure you've thought this through. So don't people want clothing designers to design their clothes? I mean, isn't customization limited? I mean, I'm wearing a shirt from Thomas Pink, and I am much happier to have Thomas Pink design my shirt than to have me design my shirt because I don't know how to design a shirt, and frankly, I don't want to design my shirt.
Yes.
So how do you? What are the limits of mass customization? How do you deal with that?
Yeah. Well, you don't want to design the shirt. But you want somebody who's good at it to do it.
Right.
So in mass customization, we're often imagining that you're going to design your own shirt. And at Bombsheller, you could do that. You could make your own design. But we don't really cater to end users or customers in making designs. We seek out artists and designers and Thomas Pink to do it.
Right.
And the point of it is, you know, you're wearing a shirt from a successful designer. He doesn't really need Bombsheller because he could probably figure out how to go sell 100,000 of his latest design to Target and get it on a shelf or something.
Right.
You know, if you're a small designer, it's wildly impractical to make clothes. What a normal fashion designer would do is make some designs. They make one shirt or a pair of leggings. They put it on the runway, they'd take orders from the buyer, hopefully, if they're lucky, at Nordstrom or Walmart or someplace. If they get an order for, you know, 1,000 of those shirts in small, medium, and large, then they got to get factory time in China. They got to get the material sourced, get it there. They got to get those things made. Then they get put on a barge and sent back to America. Then they send them to Nordstrom. They go on the shelf. They wait for you to buy it. And then 90 days later, the designer gets paid.
Right.
So you're paying to put stuff on the shelf. And if it doesn't sell, Nordstrom sends it back to you and doesn't and charges you for wasting space on their shelf. They literally do that.
Yeah.
So it's wildly impractical for a designer to go through all that. You have to be pretty well financed to do it. And because of it, the designer has to be conservative. They have to sell. They have to make designs they know they can sell 1,000 of or more, right? Well, if you imagine Bombsheller, I mean, right now the Bombsheller catalog has a couple hundred, 300 designs in it, I don't know. And we get new designs every single day. We get designs from designers all over the world. Some of them are targeting yoga. Mm-hmm. Some of them target heavy metal and have skulls on them. Some of them have the Seahawks logo on them. Some of them have stuff that roller girls like. Well, if you're into yoga, and you know, you're not going to want to wear the same graphics or designs that someone who's into roller derby wants to wear. Those girls have no overlap in their Venn diagram. And that's okay. You know, but you can't go to H&M and buy something that targets roller derby. It's too small of a niche.
Right.
Right? And so the truth is, you know, we're used to it. You and I, our entire lives, have been treated like lowest common denominators by the apparel industry. You know, that shirt is a medium or whatever, and it's because, you know, that's all they can do. But the truth is, you look around, you know, people are all shaped differently. They're different sizes. And their interests are different. You know, and you know, you may or may not be trying to express too much about yourself with that shirt, other than you fit into this place where you live and work and whatnot. But the people's like interests and their things that they want to try and express can be a lot more broad than that. And so to do it, we have to come up with ways to make it possible for you to do whatever you want. And so until a product can be made for one person, we'll always be averaging them out.
By the way, when you talk about what you're doing, it does make the current model seem really old, really antiquated.
Yes.
Couple more questions on Bombsheller. So Bombsheller is a blank company. It's not a tights company. How would you label it?
We're the clothing company of the future.
Okay.
We started from scratch, and we watched a bunch of Star Trek, so we know that in the future everyone's going to be wearing spandex. So we started with that.
Sure.
And we built the whole company. I mean, it's a radically different company. Everything here is under one roof. The web people, the marketing people, photography, the factory is in this building, and our seamstresses are in this building. And we can change anything in 20 minutes if we decide we don't like the way it's going. So even if Bombsheller isn't doing things the best way now, we can change faster than anyone in the world. No one can move faster than us. And so we will figure out what the future of apparel manufacturing is going to be like more, you know, faster than anyone.
All right, so your official answer, because I know how these things go, Pablos.
Yep.
Your official answer is we're going to build a successful, profitable, sustainable business to accrue value to our shareholders. However, if you had to imagine an exit, what kind of company would buy Bombsheller? Is it Google? Is it The Gap? Is it Macy's? I mean, who buys you guys?
Well, I think there's a couple things going on. You know, with Bombsheller, we want to be as flexible as we can to discover what's possible, so we don't take investors. You know, once you do that, you really have to focus on getting a return for the investors. And we want to be focused on figuring out how the future of this industry can go. And that's not what investors typically have as a motivation. So we don't take money from the outside. But as an exit, you know, we're not, because of that, you know, we're not really focused on the exit. It's a little too soon for us to do that. But if I were a big company like Zara, like H&M, like Bloomingdale's, like Nordstrom, like anybody, you know, any of those guys needs to be at the forefront in the future. They need to be the ones who make it happen at a large scale. And they're not built for experimentation. They're not built for figuring it out. So the right thing for them to do is to sit back, keep a close eye on Baumstiller and other companies like ours, try and invest in them when they can so that they get a front row seat. And then once they prove something works, then, you know, buy them up and bring it to their global manufacturing and marketing and distribution and all the things that they can do at a large scale that a startup can.
I think that's a logical strategy. Yeah. If you have an open investment round, just let me know. I'm in. sounds like I missed the boat. Anyway, okay, so let's hit the Wayback Machine. You've given a really interesting accounting of what you're doing now and some of your adventures with Myhrvold and elsewhere. What were you like as a kid? I can only, as a father myself, I can only imagine. I mean, I would imagine that you may have gotten into trouble a couple of times. So what does a baby hacker Pablos look like? What were you doing?
Well, I grew up in Alaska in the cold and the dark with nothing to do. And for a nerd in Alaska without a lot of friends, I mean, I was in a small town with no friends. And I had one of the first computers you could get. I got an Apple II when I was 9 years old or something. And in those days, computers were useless. You know, you couldn't really do anything with them. All you could do was hacking and just poking at it to try and figure out, you know, what was possible. But it was enough, kind of like a MakerBot is now. It was enough to spark your imagination. You could think, well, man, this thing, someday when it's faster and has more memory, you'll be able to do cool stuff with a computer. And so I got started on that very young, mostly imagining what I could do with a computer. And you know, everybody else in the world who had a computer in those days probably had a job or something. Well, I was a kid and I had 16 hours a day I could spend learning about computers. And so I learned a lot, and then by like 1983, I got online in what was called ARPANET, you know, one of the first sort of networks, and it was just mainframe. So I had to like dial into a mainframe, and then from there I could talk to other people. And all those other people were like, you know, PhD students working on computer science, so they knew a lot that I didn't know, and I could just bug them all day, and they didn't know I was a kid. And so so I learned a lot that way on just hanging out on mainframes, talking to people. And then, you know, what I was doing was trying. I was so interested in making computers do something. And by the time I got out of high school, computers had, you know, the first Macintosh had started to get used in some industries like publishing and printing, you know. And there was things like PageMaker, which was the first program for like, you know, doing magazines, newspapers, right, and stuff. And so every company that had been around for 50 years whose job was to publish stuff had a team with a graphic art designer and a typesetter and a paste up table with a Yoo-hoo stick and a photo stripper, all these different people whose job was to help make a printed thing for a print shop. And those people were all losing their jobs to one guy with a Macintosh. And so I was 18 years old, and my first job out of high school was going to print shops and teaching them, you know, teaching 40-year-old people how to use a Mac to do the job they've been doing for 20 years. And some of them didn't like that. Right. But it was kind of the first wave of computers taking over a job where people were just unsuspecting. You know, they didn't see it coming. And but what I loved about it, I loved it when somebody embraced it. You know, when I found somebody who was excited about that, I'm like, oh, wow, I can do the whole thing now. I don't need all those other people. I can do it faster. It can help me, you know. And I got really hooked on, putting computers to use. I wanted to do things with them. And that's not what universities were doing. You know, there was no, what computer science departments were teaching was the science of computation and how chips work and stuff like that. And I knew a lot of that stuff, and I also, it wasn't what I wanted to learn more about. I wanted to build stuff with computers. And so my whole career has been in, finding ways to put computers to use, doing something they haven't done before and cram them into places where they haven't been before and sometimes maybe shouldn't go. And I've been doing that in one way or another for, it's getting to be a really long time now, since 1980s. And eventually, I got lucky because eventually computers did get faster and did get powerful and cheaper, and now we can put them in anything. And so as an inventor, I kind of cheat by just looking around in the world and finding all the places where computers haven't gone yet and trying to imagine what it would be like if they did, What would happen? In the 80s, I wanted a computer in my car, and everyone thought I was crazy. And I wanted a computer hooked up to my phone, and people thought that was crazy. And now you have 70 computers in your car, and you're hauling around a, supercomputer in your pocket that, has 115 gigaflops. I mean, who knows what to do with that amount of power? And that's why you have, so many fart apps on your iPhone. You're just like looking for ways to waste computational ability.
I got rid of all of those, Pablos.
What's that?
I got rid of all my fart apps.
Oh, you deleted the fart apps. Yeah, there's some really good ones now. Yeah. They use the accelerometer and your gyros. Yeah. So I think of it as, this kind of natural progression. We're trying to invent all kinds of uses for computers, and changing manufacturing is chief among them. I mean, when you go in a lot of factories these days, I've been to amazing factories, I got invited to go visit the world's largest pasta factory, which I thought was amazing. And I got to see the whole factory from one end to the other. And it's this gargantuan electromechanical machine from the 60s.
Right.
And there's not a single computer chip in it.
Yep.
And that's true for the way a lot of things are made. And so we have to go reimagine, what would it be like if you made pasta with computer chips? Would it be better? Would it be more efficient? Would it be faster, cheaper, more humane? And then we need to do that for everything else. I don't know about pasta, but for apparel, I can tell you there are a zillion ways to improve the way that we make clothes. And so, with Bombsheller, we start from scratch, and we can, get all those improvements in one fell swoop.
So, Pablos, your title when you were at IV was Master Hacker. What is a hacker? What is that? Because it has kind of a negative term, but hackers can do good things too, like what you're doing now.
Yeah. So, I'm a hacker, which is kind of like being a scientist, but without all the formal training and accountability. And hackers have kind of a different mindset or a different learning style. Hackers are just going to try everything. We're just trying to discover what's possible. And that's an important thing. For an inventor, a hacker is a great mind to have around, because if you're inventing, what you're trying to do is take every new scientific discovery, every new chip, every new sensor. That's kind of a new superpower that you get. And so every day I get those things, and I have to match them up with the problems that the world has, So I fill my brain with new technologies on one side, I fill my brain with big problems on the other side, and I try to match them up. And I ask myself, does this change anything humans have ever done? And sometimes I get a match, right? Sometimes we can solve a problem. And that's why technology is exciting and it never ends. So I still work in the lab. As an inventor, my job is to invent new technologies, and that's what I love to do. Bombsheller is an exciting side project, but in my mind, contributes to that. But I think it's really important. You know, we have not done a great job of supporting and celebrating inventors, and we need more of them to solve. I mean, you know, we're making more humans all the time. We're good at making more problems, so we need to scale up invention.
You'll always be busy. So let's talk about cybersecurity generally. So our mutual friend Rob Wolcott, the head of the Kellogg Innovation Network, has spoken publicly, and this is a really provocative thought, terrorists and really innovative entrepreneurs are actually two sides of the same coin. And I guess you could, you know, especially given what happened with the Sony hacking and all this, you could in some ways lump terrorists and bad hackers into the same kind of camp. Two sides of the same coin. So how do we promote hacking for good? How do we reach out to people wherever they are and encourage them to use their curiosity and technology skills to better humankind rather than destroy it?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I was probably one of the first people to sort of publicly admit I'm a hacker, right? And claim that in a way that that scared a lot of people because they had this sort of criminal association.
Yeah.
And I wanted to fix that because hackers aren't criminals. They're just, you know, very curious. And security problems are kind of a, you know, bottomless pit of intriguing curiosities. You know, it's like they're sort of asking for us to figure out if we can break them, you know, and I think that's a really important thing.
Hacker magnets.
Yeah, and there certainly are criminals who take that stuff and go try and exploit it for profit. You know, some more clever than others. But a lot of times these days, the criminals are just taking hacks that other people figured out and, you know, deploying them in a larger scale fashion or more nefarious fashion. And so, I think it's actually getting more clear the distinction between hackers and criminals. And these days, being a hacker has turned out to be cool. It's not even considered a professional liability anymore because you know, Facebook claims they're hiring hackers and stuff. So it's it's progressed, I think, as far as you know what it means in people's minds. But I think of hacking as a learning style. You know, hacking is fundamentally about just not reading the directions. It's about, you know, taking something and, you know, I've used the example often of saying, you know, if you get a new gadget and you show it to your mom or your grandma, she might ask you, what does this do? And you can explain, mom, it's an iPhone. That's why it says phone on it. You know, it's a phone. And she can understand, oh, I got it. Well, with a hacker, if you give a hacker a new gadget, the question is different. The question is, what can I make this do?
Yeah.
And that's a radically different approach to the world. They're not going to read the directions. They're going to flip it over, take out all the screws, break it into a lot of little pieces, and then figure out what we can build from the rubble. And that discovery process of, you know, figuring out what's possible with every new technology is fundamental to innovation. It's fundamental to invention. I mean, that's where it has to start. Without it, you don't get anything new. Right. You cannot get a new technology or a new invention by reading the directions.
Well,
it's never happened once in history, and it never will. So you need those brains. And, you know, unfortunately, we're sequestering them off in the computer security department, configuring firewalls, instead of putting them in a lab inventing stuff like I do.
You know, so, you've just caused me to really rethink my own role as a parent, and let me tell you why. So I've got a 5-year-old kid, Paul III, really curious, adventurous guy, and we like to build things out of Legos. And
yes,
so, over the holidays completed the Millennium Falcon, which had like almost 3,000 pieces or something. It was crazy. And as any Lego person knows, you have to follow the instructions precisely because the whole thing falls apart as soon as you miss one move. So I've been harping with Paul, buddy, you gotta follow the instructions, because what he naturally likes to do is take the pieces and create all these wild things on his own that have nothing to do with the Millennium Falcon. And so I've been discouraging that. And from this point forward, Pablos, with all of our listeners as my witness, I am going to encourage my son to not read the instructions every time. And some of the things he might build could be much cooler than the Millennium Falcon.
I think that's exactly the right plan. I have the opposite problem. I have an 8-year-old daughter. She wants to build the thing on the cover of the box. And I'm like, well, you know, we could build whatever we want. And so, you know, she has accepted that and started building stuff her own way, but she still wants to build the thing on the cover of the box when it's new. But I think you've got exactly the right idea, you know. Legos are a wonderful playground for that, because you can do whatever you want and imagine whatever you want. And it's hard to do that with a lot of other things.
Yeah, so I think one thing we've learned from this interview is Legos are good. We embrace. By the way, there are a lot of Lego-like innovations out there. Magnetiles is one. They're popping up all over the place. They're so great.
Well, that, and you know, he should play Minecraft.
Yeah, he's into Minecraft. Yep.
Good. Yeah. And Minecraft building stuff.
$2 billion, I think Microsoft bought them for, something like that. So it shows you the value of a really well-constructed system. Yeah. So, final question, and then we'll sadly close, because I'm having so much darn fun here. Are you optimistic from the perspective of cybersecurity? You know, here we are talking to a famous hacker. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about our future security in this environment?
Well, I think it's a philosophical thing, you know. We're never going to build anything secure. And eventually you realize that when you work on security. You know, we always imagine, at least initially, it took me an embarrassingly long time to realize that I was never going to win and make things secure when I was trying to. And what I realized is what matters more is resilience. And,
right.
And the ability to create things that aren't fragile. Because... you can't anticipate what's going to go wrong. And that's what you learn from hacking, is that when you're building a product, you're trying to make it do all the things that it's supposed to do for the user. You don't have time to think about what hackers are going to do to it, because they're going to think of everything you never thought of. And you can't defend against all those things, or you'll end up building something that's useless and heavy. And
right.
So you learn that fundamentally, or at a fundamental level, internalize it at a fundamental level when you work on hacking and security. And so it made me appreciate the difference between security and risk management.
Right.
So going back to that credit card example, the credit card industry is a horrible example of security, and it doesn't matter at all. They do not have a security problem. They have a risk management problem. And they have managed the risk. When I steal your credit card number and go shopping on victoriasecret.com, the credit card industry makes money off of the fraud.
Okay.
And that's a very resilient thing to do. And so I don't believe in a future where we figure out how to make computers secure. We don't actually know how to do that. Even academically, we don't even know how to make a secure computer unless you unplug it from the wall. And so... you know, what I think is we can make more resilient systems. And, you know, biology gives us a zillion great examples that we've failed to learn from. You know, your body is like 99% error correction. Cells are dying off all the time. Everything's going wrong all the time. And somehow, you know, we still keep you going for quite a while. You know?
Right.
And that's because the system is very resilient. And I think, you know, there's been a really wonderful diatribe on this written by Nassim Taleb, which is called Anti-Fragile, which is wonderful. I don't think he even thought of computer security when he wrote it, but it very clearly outlines how computers need to be architected in the future to be what he calls anti-fragile instead of secure.
Right,
so that they benefit from and improve every time they have a problem. In some ways, we do that with system update. You know, we find these security problems and we patch them, but we don't make the computer better. We just, you know, go plug in holes.
Right. Very interesting, Pablos. Okay, final question is kind of a non sequitur. You are a fanatical salsa dancer. I know this because every time we get together, you know, you'll do your talk, we'll have dinner, and then you're like, where's the salsa club? And I'm like, this is where I go home and you go out. Yeah. So you're a big salsa dancer. You've done salsa all over the world. What can innovators learn from salsa dancing?
Well, I think for me, you know, I got into dancing because I had trained in martial arts, and I was interested in this kind of physical communication, where even though I didn't speak Japanese, you know, I was able to communicate to somebody who was attacking me that I wanted them to gently shove their head into the ground. And when I saw dancers, I realized, you know, partner dancers, who like tango dancers or salsa dancers, they were, you know, leading each other, communicating physically but without talking, and they were very subtle about it. And I thought that they were learning the same thing I was trying to learn in martial arts. So I decided to try dancing. And, you know, it turned out to be a great upgrade, because now instead of training with sweaty old Japanese guys, it's sweaty young Latin girls. And a lot of fun.
Right.
But it also, you know, one of the amazing, there's so many amazing things you can learn from dancing, but, you know, when you're a beginner, you really suck, you still have to ask a girl to dance. And, you know, usually she'll be polite and dance with you, even if you suck. And when you're done, you can tell that it wasn't fun for her and that you really sucked. But you don't know why you suck. You don't know how to fix it. She never tells you what you're doing wrong. And that's true for years and years until you get really good. And then that happens less often. It doesn't ever stop. Even now, I'll dance with a girl and it won't go well. You can tell I'm not doing her style or whatever it is that, you know, that would match us up. And she never tells you that why it sucked. You can just tell that it sucked. And so you have to figure it out. You have to kind of reverse engineer with every dance, like, what's going to work? How am I going to connect with this person, make our styles work together with this music? And like, so it's this wonderful analogy for learning other things, I think, is that, you know, you don't get any direct feedback. And I think of it as going back to that thing I said about learning styles. You know, if you're in a class with an instructor giving you a lecture, telling you how the world works, you know, that's different than if you're like sitting there with a screwdriver, taking your VCR apart and trying to guess how it worked. Nobody's telling you if you guessed wrong. You have to keep trying things so you figure it out. So I think dancing has worked out great for me. It's a good way to keep a geek active. You can do it anywhere in the world, whether you speak the language or not. So,
well said, Pablo. So I can't thank you enough. Our listeners can't thank you enough. Absolutely fascinating. Pablos Holman, futurist, inventor, hacker, dancer, and an architect of what's next in lots of different spaces. Thank you very much, and Happy New Year.
Thanks, Paul. I appreciate it.